Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
After Paris, seeking a strategy. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Almost 200 raids without search warrants have been conducted amid reports that there were advance warnings of Friday's attacks. More are predicted. There is new urgency to the debate about the fight against ISIS. President François Hollande says France is at war. Here's President Obama today.
There will be an intensification of the strategy that we put forward.
Airstrikes have increased, and there are calls for boots on the ground. There are also warnings that military escalation by Western countries is just what ISIS is hoping for. Today's talking point, the impact of Paris on next year's campaign to succeed President Obama. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Alney back with To the Point. CIA Director John Brennan says Friday's attacks in Paris were planned in advance and that others are sure to be in the pipeline. Debate is raging over how the U.S. and its allies should retaliate against ISIS and strategize for the future. Today's talking point, candidates for president in both political parties are weighing in. Will direct experience in foreign policy make a political difference? First, this news update. Since Friday, French President François Hollande has said repeatedly that France is at war. Today, at the G20 summit in Turkey, President Obama took questions from an auditorium full of reporters from around the world. He was asked repeatedly if he plans to change American strategy.
There will be an intensification of the strategy that we put forward, but the strategy that we are putting forward is the strategy that ultimately is going to work. But as I said from the start, it's going to take time. And what's been interesting is in the aftermath of Paris, as I listen to those who suggest something else needs to be done, typically, the things they suggest need to be done are things we are already doing.
Michael Crowley, a senior foreign policy reporter for Politico, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Just last Thursday on ABC News, President Obama told George Stephanopoulos that ISIS is being contained. Given that statement, what was the tone of the questioning today in Turkey, and what was the tone of the president's response?
Well, the tone of the questioning was almost prosecutorial, and or with a dash of "Don't you get it?" I think, you know, over and over the same questions. Your strategy is not working. What are you going to do about it? And the president's tone was, you know, on that particular subject, I think a real kind of weariness and understanding that what he is trying to describe is a complicated, long-term project that doesn't boil down to an unsatisfying bumper sticker. And you know, I heard frustration with the president feeling like he was getting the same question over and over again and to some degree saying, aren't you people listening to me?
And saying, as we just heard him say, that what people are proposing is what he's already doing.
Yeah, I think that that was a point he reiterated over and over, and you do hear that very often. His Republican rivals in particular will say things that really don't differ much from what he's actually doing, with certain exceptions that he likes to highlight. In some cases, for instance, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who talks about, you know, 10, 20 or more thousand U.S. troops going into the country, escalating by a factor of about 10 what we've sent to Iraq. And President Obama is quite happy to knock that down and say he thinks it's a dumb idea.
Well, what is the United States doing? And what about the statement today by the director of the CIA, John Brennan, who said that the attacks in Paris were planned. There are more in the pipeline. Does that suggest that they knew in advance what was going to happen?
Well, it doesn't appear that they knew with any specificity. I think the problem is right now you just have this constant drumbeat of alerts because there are hundreds of ISIS sympathizers in Europe and in the U.S. Who seem to have an interest in killing Westerners. And there is a lot of what they call chatter. And it's hard for them to know what really rises to the level of being actionable enough. So I think that they had a sense that there was something in the works, but they didn't have specifics on it. It's very hard to track down all these potential threats.
One of the things that the president was asked about today, and one of the things that he seemed most passionate about, was the issue of refugees from Syria. Several governors have said today that they will not accept any refugees from Syria, given what has happened and the association with one of the terrorists with a Syrian passport. Here's what the president said.
Many of these refugees are the victims of terrorism themselves. That's what they're fleeing. Slamming the door in their faces would be a betrayal of our values. Our nations can welcome refugees who are desperately seeking safety and ensure our own security. We can and must do both.
Michael Crowley, back to you. That's going to be a political problem.
Well, perhaps. I will say that, you know, the president on that subject really grew animated and impassioned in a way that he wasn't earlier in the press conference. When he was defending his strategy, again, there was a kind of weary resignation, slightly testy. On this one, this really seemed to be, he seemed to be speaking with just a little more heart and a little more passion, and maybe that this is kind of a newer issue, but he got fired up. But it is a political problem. I think that the public is, people are really scared right now, and they may not be inclined to give refugees the benefit of the doubt, and it's going to be a tough battle for President Obama. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has also been calling for tolerance of refugees, but you know, in Europe, I think the right-wing nativist parties are really going to be surging. So that is going to be one of the great. That's going to be the fallout from these Paris attacks.
Okay, we're just about out of time, but I take it that the subject of the G20, which was supposed to be economics, has somewhat been subsumed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the attacks are crowding everything out, and there's still a lot of unfinished work among these countries at the G20, for instance, trying to get Turkey to crack down more on its borders, the Saudi role in trying to tamp down radicalism. So to have all those countries in that place, it's an opportunity the president doesn't want to miss right now.
All right, Michael Crowley with the Politico. Great to have you on our program. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment after Paris, seeking a strategy on To the Point from PRI.
Wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. In the past few hours, there have been more than 150 raids by French police without the benefit of search warrants. President Francois Hollande, as we've heard, has declared war on ISIS, and he's called for a meeting of the UN Security Council. Janine DiGiovanni is based in Paris. She is Middle East editor for Newsweek, and she's also author of a new book, The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
There is an election coming up in just 3 weeks in France. How does this all play into that?
Well, this is a very big worry for some of us here because basically the attacks on Friday night as well as the attacks, the Charlie Hebdo attacks last January, play very much into the hands of the right wing. Most particularly Marine Le Pen, who has gained more and more popularity by making this national tragedy akin to their own personal agenda. The xenophobia, the fear of foreigners, more immigration, the factor about the open borders, which of course is a huge worry here, especially given that we know that the killers, the attackers from Friday night, originated or had strong links to Belgium and might have had some to Germany. So the vulnerability that the French people feel with these with the border, the open borders, is highlighted by the right wing. It plays right into their hands. So there's a big concern about this. And also, Hollande is not a popular president. He's stood up in the past 3 days. He's been quite extraordinary, as he was as well during the Charlie Hebdo attacks. But on the ground, people don't like him, and there is a grave concern that the right wing will use this opportunity, this national tragedy, to go further in the elections. And remember, we've got presidential elections in 2017. So this is a concern.
What about his actions now, then? You say he is standing up and showing that he is tough. He's called for war against ISIS and asked for the UN Security Council to have a hearing. Pardon me. Is that all part of the same thing, then? Is he campaigning with all of these warrantless raids that are being conducted? And has anybody been arrested?
Well, there were more than 100 house arrests, as well as I think 160 house searches. Now, the important point here, for me anyway, is that will these attacks have implications about the civil liberties in France? And this is a big issue in the UK, a huge debate. France is a country that holds their civil liberties very close to their heart. After the Charlie Hebdo attacks last January, a law was passed, I think it went through in May, which isn't completely implemented, but which allows them to wiretap, to conduct heightened surveillance without judicial authority. So this is a concern for human rights groups here. There's also, for many of us, a concern about what will happen to the refugee situation. How will this play out in the coming weeks? Angela Merkel and Hollande are going to be under a huge amount of pressure. So we're really just watching and seeing what will happen. But I do think it's extremely important, as someone that lives in France and covered the riots here in 2005, which in a sense were a hallmark to many of us about beginning to realize the alienation that many young Muslim French-born youth feel about French society, that they feel that they're not a part of it. They feel that they don't have participation. They feel that they don't have a voice. Partially, the history of this is that the French Constitution from 1905 has this entity called la laïcité, which is secularism, which has been a very painful process. For instance, banning headscarves for young Muslim girls. So this has been, as we've been soul-searching the past 3 days, as we've been going over why France, why is it here, there's many factors to look at. There is the lack of Muslim integration. There is the fact that secularism has come at a price. And there's also the fact that this is playing right into the hands of the extreme right wing, which has gained popularity. So all of these.
And excuse me for interrupting you, but are they charging President Hollande with missing the boat and not taking action in advance when they knew that there might be attacks?
You know, the DGSI, the security, there have been obviously huge gaps. They can be excellent at times, but I think in this case, we knew it was a matter of not if there would be attack, but when. France had been targeted before. There were signs about it. I don't think he is getting as much flack as, say, Obama is now for missing out on ISIS, on the coming of ISIS, and not being more on the ball and keeping his eyes on it. I think more, to be honest, I think right now the country's in a state of shock. And Hollande, by calling the Joint Congress this afternoon at Versailles, his speech was extremely sharp, I tried to count the number of times he said, "We are at war," kind of playing into the French psyche right now, which feels very vulnerable, very exposed. The airstrikes last night at Raqqa, in some sense, might be provocative, but on the other hand, I'm of two minds of it, because it was something he had to do to restore national confidence, because France may appear to be proud and firm, but it's right now feeling extremely vulnerable.
Okay, Raqqa, of course, the city in Syria, which is the headquarters for ISIS. I want to get back to you, Janine DiGiovanni, because I know you've been in Syria a lot, and that's part of your next book. But first, let's go to Sebastian Rotella. He's a senior reporter for ProPublica. He covers terrorism as a foreign correspondent, has done so for many years, and he's author of the book The Convert's Song, in which he explores the terrorist underworld in the housing projects of Paris. Sebastian Rotella, good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Warren.
What about the accusation that they should have been able to head this off?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to, in retrospect, to say that. I think everyone knew, as your guests said, that there were a lot of signs, a lot of intelligence, a lot of warnings. There have been a stream of plots that have been dismantled before and after Charlie Hebdo. There was a stepped-up campaign by the French with U.S. help to target in the past year at least four individuals unaware of French foreign fighters with al-Qaeda and with the Islamic State in Syria. Some of those strikes were successful. Some weren't. One was just last month in October by the French. So I think it's true that the idea was that an attack was inevitable. Now, the dimensions of it, you know, the use of three groups, the number of targets, that I think was startling, even to those who expected something. But the threat, it was really, I mean, unprecedented in terms of volume, the number of people going and coming back to Syria and Iraq, the intensity of radicalization on the internet, and frankly, the savagery of the people connected to the Islamic State and their willingness to go, you know, just to carry out indiscriminate violence of the kind that they, you know, are steeped on the Syrian battlefield.
There is now a connection, of course, to Brussels, and there has been identified a potential mastermind who hasn't been found yet. Will you tell us a bit about him and the Brussels connection?
Well, as in the past, it appears that this is a mixed network of French and Belgians, and that this mastermind, or the suspected mastermind, whose people are talking about and some officials have told me about, but you know, who has some links and certainly seems to have played some role, is a young Belgian in his 20s, in his late 20s, early 30s, named Abdelhamid Abaoud, who has been a foreign fighter based in Syria, but has been coming back and forth. And I heard a lot about him in January after the Charlie Hebdo attacks and when I was in France a few months ago, because he was the alleged mastermind of a group of Belgian foreign fighters who made their way back from Syria and were planning an attack in the city of Verviers. And two of them were killed in a police raid when Belgian, French, and U.S. intelligence detected the plot and went after them. But I think the thesis that is emerging is that this was a mixed group of Belgians and French, but based particularly in the Molenbeek area near Brussels, which has been a long-time outpost of Islamic extremism, where lots and lots of young men have been going to foreign battlefields, including Syria and Iraq, over the years, and where there's a lot of people, sort of guys coming from a criminal background, like this Abdelhamid Abaoud, who radicalized very quickly and are going to the Islamic State and are really caught up in the intoxication of what's going on in Syria and the fact that they're able to go to Syria, get training, engage in combat, engage in torture. I mean, the level of violence is really attracting some very violent and people. And the thinking is that he was involved in a series of attempts, including the one that I just described in Verviers and a couple of others over the past couple of years, and that he would have played at least some role in plotting this. What's known for sure is that he does have links to the one Salah Abdeslam, the Frenchman who was living in Brussels, who's now a wanted fugitive, who was connected to renting the cars that were used in the attack. So there are definite connections in the criminal and extremist underworld, but it remains to be seen if, in fact, he's the mastermind and if he's the only one. I mean, what I think a lot of people think is that the Islamic State has really entrusted its plotting of attacks in the West to its foreign fighters. So the people who the French and the Belgians are most worried about are these senior foreign fighters in the sense that they're not that old, late 20s, early 30s, but who have gained the trust of the Islamic State and are given a great deal of leeway and autonomy to come up with targets and plot attacks in the territory that they know the best, back home in France and Belgium.
Sebastian Rotella with ProPublica. Let me go back to Janine DiGiovanni, who is in Paris. Where do the weapons come from? And what about the black market in weaponry? Does that go back to that issue that you mentioned earlier that Marie Le Pen is concerned about, and that's the open borders?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the statistics of weaponry, especially light weaponry, in the UK, it's far lower than it is in France. And we've seen that one, that there have been links to Germany. I know that your listeners know this, but the living in Europe, the fact that you can cross borders so easily without producing any identity cards, any documents, has just made this so much easier. So this is definitely one of the factors. As Sebastian mentioned as well, you know, France has the highest Muslim population in all of Europe, and so there have been a significant, I think it's 2,000 fighters who have gone to fight for ISIS. But there is something else I wanted to point out about foreign fighters, which is that I've just come back from Tunisia researching the fighters that go from there, because Tunisia has one of the highest populations of fighters going to join the jihad. They are not, they don't fit into the profile you would find in France or the UK of these disenfranchised, alienated youth. In fact, they're highly educated, because Tunisia does have one of the highest educational systems in the Arab world. Theirs is very different. It's a lack of opportunity, which, of course, was one of the springboards for the Jasmine Revolution. They graduate from university, and they have absolutely nothing in front of them, no hope, no future. And the returnees that I spoke to and interviewed in Tunisia, who had gone to fight in Raqqa and for ISIS, came back because they were very disillusioned with what they found. But they were recruited by using this kind of going for their vulnerability, and that they don't have a future, and ISIS was offering them something, a position in society, a place where they could really make their name, which is something they can't do back home.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but I want to play for our listeners a bit more of what President Obama had to say today about the challenge of countering ISIS and the people that you're talking about, and the kind of motivations that they have.
It's not their sophistication or the particular weaponry that they possess, but it is the ideology that they carry with them and their willingness to die. And in those circumstances, tracking each individual, making sure that we are disrupting and preventing these attacks is a constant effort at vigilance.
Before we go to a break, we have a minute left, and I want to introduce Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Thank you for joining us. Under these circumstances, what about the attacks on so-called soft targets that we've seen in Paris? I'll give you a minute to answer this question, then come back to you after our break. Is there any way to stop it?
You can't get 100% security in any kind of open society, and not even in more authoritarian countries like China and Russia, which have had problems with this. I think the small consolation, but it's an important one, is that the level of threat, the level of these attacks is still far less than we've seen at other moments in world history. If you consider the carnage that Europe went through in World Wars I and II, what has happened happened last week, while tragic, is not of that scale. And we have to also remind ourselves that our societies are tougher than this and are actually quite resilient. We've seen similar atrocities happen in Boston, in Oslo, in New York, in Madrid, in Ankara. And these societies and these cities recover. They're thriving today. Paris, the City of Lights, will be there long after these perpetrators are gone and mostly forgotten. And so we have to both take it seriously closely, but also recognize that these attacks, while shocking and awful, are not an existential threat to all we hold dear.
And we lost 3,000 people on September 11th, 2001, here in the United States. Again, we're going to be talking about the impact of the atrocities on the American presidential campaign, but we'll continue this conversation with our current guests and others as well in a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Well, and I'll be back with To the Point. Once again, of course, talking about the attacks in Paris last Friday night. We just heard from Stephen Walt of the John F. Kennedy School of Government that atrocious as they were, devastating as they were, particularly to people who live in Paris, they're nothing by comparison to World War II and lesser than some other terrible things that strong societies have recovered from. So, Stephen Walt, what then can be done, and what is required at this point?
Well, first of all, we want to react with our heads, not our hearts, and worse yet, not our gut instincts here. And I think we have to recognize that ISIS does have a strategy here, and we don't want to fall for it. Their primary strategy is to try and continue to increase the amount of polarization between them and the rest of the world, and indeed between the rest of the world and the Arab and Islamic world. They have written, in fact, about wanting to eliminate what they call the gray zone, the mass of undecided people. If they can foment enough conflict, if they can get us to overreact or react in ways that play into their narrative, their hope is, of course, more recruits will flow, more people in different parts of the world will decide that they're on the side of right and that we are not. We have to understand that that's their objective and not do things that might actually facilitate it or strengthen it.
What about the pressure on President Obama at this point? And do you think that he is reacting as well as he could?
Yeah, I think he is clearly facing exactly the kind of pressure you would expect of people who want to sort of lash out and do something and believe that a problem like this can be solved, simply with air power or by military force. But force alone is not the answer to this problem. I think we've seen that now for the past 14 years or so. We routed the Taliban. We eventually got bin Laden. We invaded Iraq. And none of those things have actually ended the problem we face from violent extremism. Of course, it was the invasion of Iraq that unintentionally led to the emergence of groups like ISIS as well. So again, I think recognizing that there are real limits to what you can accomplish with military force is part of the long-term solution here.
We've been joined by Bruce Hoffman. He's a professor and director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. Good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Warren.
What about the use of force? What about the have there been failures of intelligence that leading up to what happened in Paris?
Well, I mean, it's always tempting to blame this on failures of intelligence, but of course, France has been at its highest of four states of alert since last June. It's scarlet alert, which is that an attack of some sort is imminent. So, you know, again, I think as was said earlier, it was a matter of when, not if. But I think what we're seeing in France and indeed in other countries, the United States included, is that the intelligence and security services as well as law enforcement are just being flooded basically by an exponentially larger number of leads than they've ever had to follow before. ISIS is unique in that it's reportedly attracted somewhere between 20 and 25,000 foreign fighters. There's also the quote-unquote lone wolf threat, radicalized individuals who don't leave a country that require monitoring, would-be foreign fighters attempting to leave, tracking them coming back. And basically what you have is security and intelligence services and police forces that are just completely overwhelmed. And in some cases, I would argue, as part of ISIS's strategy, are deliberately preoccupied by the low-hanging fruit, let's say by the radicalized individuals or the lone wolves, in hopes that precisely a group of attackers such as made their way to Paris before the weekend could slip under the radar and strike.
So if there is then coordination of much of this from Raqqa in Syria, where ISIS has its headquarters, is it time to just take them out?
Well, you know, the problem in counterterrorism, as Steve was stating, is much more complex than that. The one aspect of ISIS that makes it so formidable is that it has adapted and adjusted to even our most consequential countermeasures over the past 15 months or so. And in fact, I would argue that the planning cells for this attack, the orders may have been issued by Raqqa, but the planning cells themselves were outside of harm's way. In other words, they were not in Syria. They were not susceptible to airstrikes or bombings that would have disrupted them. And therefore, what we've seen is a threat that has metastasized and spread to Turkey, to Greece, and to the Balkans as well.
So, Stephen Wald, back to you at the John F. Kennedy School. Is this as complex as it appears to Bruce Hoffman?
I think that's basically right here. The ultimate long-term solution here is going to be the creation of more effective institutions in much of the Arab and Islamic world. That is not something that the United States or France can simply import or create, and certainly not create with the use of the U.S. Army or drones or any of the other tools that are easy to use but don't really solve the problem. And I think in the near term, as I suggested before, partly we need to encourage resilience, people to not be as terrified of this set of events as, of course, ISIS would like us to be, and also to recognize that, you know, in a funny way, the best offense here is a better defense, that we are going to have to continue to redouble our efforts to lower the probability of these events while recognizing that you can't drive that probability to zero.
Let me introduce Shadi Hamid. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of Temptations of Power, Islamists, and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thank you.
We've heard about the disaffection of so many Islamic people in France and in Tunisia and in other places as well. What about more effective institutions in the Middle East? And if that's what's needed, how can they be brought about?
So, I mean, part of the problem is that the U.S. has the misfortune of having some very bad allies that are brutal and authoritarian. And that's at the root of the Middle Eastern crisis in this kind of post-Arab Spring era, is that good governance is lacking, democracy is lacking, and the Obama administration, unfortunately, has gone back to business as usual, indulging autocrats and not looking at our longer-term interest in promoting better governance, political reform, and democracy. So it's also part of a bigger problem that Obama has just shown a general disinterest in getting more involved. I mean, his overarching premise is to extract the U.S. as much as possible from the Middle East. But even when we do get involved, he does so very reluctantly, as if the Middle East is a nuisance that he would rather not be dealing with. And I think we're seeing the cost of that strategy today, where Obama, he doesn't want to be doing this. And now we're forced to kind of contend with the implications.
Why should the United States do more?
Well, I think, this affects us. I mean, this idea that the Middle East is just something that we can kind of put at arm's length and we can retreat into Fortress America, that's been disproven time and time again. Our mistakes in the Middle East come back to haunt us. So we don't really have a choice at the end of the day. I mean, at some point, terrorist groups are going to attack more countries in the West, as other guests have noted. So that means that we have to think proactively about what are the longer-term root causes that we need to deal with, and that requires having a vision, it requires having a strategy, and it requires, whether we like it or not, a military component. This idea that we can just kind of stay back and continue with some air power and leave it at that, as Obama has done over the past year and a half, is just that's not going to work. And Obama, I think it's worth noting, has really discounted the importance of ISIS or the relevance of ISIS as a threat since day one. He called it the JV team, then even after ISIS took over Mosul, we didn't really do a whole lot more. We've been dragging our feet. So, I mean, there is a role for the military. I take the point of other guests that we have to be careful about not making the mistakes we've made before in places like Iraq, but there is a middle ground. It's not either intervention or non-intervention or a full-scale Iraq invasion or just kind of doing as little as possible. And we have to think about what that appropriate middle ground is.
Bruce Hoffman, back to you at Georgetown University, longtime student of the terrorist phenomenon. Do you think President Obama is, in fact, disinterested? Has he backed off of this? And has that been a mistake?
Well, I don't want to be presumptuous in inferring what the president thinks or not. What I would say is that the policy...
We can infer from his actions what he may think about it.
Well, I'll talk about the policy. The policy is failing. Of that, there's no doubt. I mean, we keep decapitating, and they keep seizing more land. Certainly, ISIS isn't being contained. If what happened in Paris on Friday was a one-off type of event, perhaps we could then just dismiss it. But it's part of a wider pattern where a whole series of attacks, at least seven ISIS attacks or plots, have been broken up, directed against the United Kingdom alone. There have been arrests of ISIS operatives in Switzerland, in Belgium, in Kosovo, and in Albania. So clearly they aren't being contained, and they're spreading. I mean, I think just as Shadi said, the misuse or the poor application of military force in the past doesn't necessarily mean that there's no role for military force in this particular conflict. I mean, I would argue, first and foremost, until we weaken ISIS, it'll be impossible to achieve any of the fundamental reforms, or it'll be impossible to stabilize the region.
Let me go back to Sebastian Rotella, our reporter from ProPublica. You spent a lot of time dealing with the terrorists themselves and their way of thinking, and particularly with regard to ISIS. How important is it for them that there be a war and that there'd be the Western powers against them, particularly the United States? And how important is the territory that they now call the caliphate? And if we were able to whittle away that territory, would we in fact make them less attractive to potential recruits?
I mean, I think obviously the territory is very important. And I think one of the things that was sort of common wisdom, even say a year ago when you talked to people in intelligence and security forces in different places, was that there was greater concern in some ways about some of the al-Qaeda offshoots in Syria and Yemen and places like that, focusing on the West, where ISIS was seen as a group that had whose priority was its territory. And then these attacks on the West were great if foreign fighters would take the initiative to do them, or if, you know, general directives were sent out to people to do things in the West, that was fine. I think the calculus is changing, as several of your guests have said, because of something like Paris and these other drumbeat of plots that are going on in the West. As far as obviously there's aggressive efforts right now underway in some ways to go after some of the key plotters, some of the leaders, some of the key planners. There's some military activity going on the ground through the Kurds. It would certainly help to whittle away, as you said, at their turf. I think it would also help a lot in terms of the threat to the West to do more on this question of foreign fighters and to get countries like Turkey and other countries that they're going through to play a more aggressive role. I mean, I think until recently, there was a lot of complaints I've heard among the people, the security people, intelligence people in France and Belgium I was hearing from, that these guys are really moving back and forth at will in Turkey, and the Turks really didn't pay that much attention or didn't see the Islamic State as a top priority. So there's a series of things that can be done. I think what some of the other guests who know more about this than I do have said about this question of being agile and measured with military responses is important. I think the other complication here, though, is that there's all these different actors in Syria, right, and Iraq, and there's the whole question of the Assad government and Iran's support for them. So when Obama and other leaders look at what to do, it's a multidimensional puzzle that goes beyond just going after and destroying this group.
So, Shadi Hamid, back to you at the Brookings Institution. What about the risks of using military force, as ISIS apparently wants to see, and not having it work? Isn't that tremendously risky?
Well, first of all, it's not necessarily correct that ISIS is trying to provoke a massive Western military response. We simply don't know what ISIS's internal calculus is, and we won't know until internal memos or other documents are released. Let's remember that we didn't really have a good sense of why Al-Qaeda did 9/11 until quite a bit later. So let's not jump to, I think we have to be careful there about what ISIS's intentions are. They may actually be underestimating the extent to which the West might increase its response or act more aggressively. Or maybe they're judging that it's worth it. So even if they would prefer to avoid a massive Western response, that the fact that this kind of puts them in the headlines and outbids Al-Qaeda and gains more recruits and kind of more momentum for ISIS, that that's actually more important, and the benefits outweigh the costs. So either way, we shouldn't be determining what we do based on what we think ISIS does or doesn't want us to do. We have to do what's in our own interest as Americans, regardless of ISIS's calculations.
Okay, so Bruce Hoffman, excuse me, back to you. You said the policy is failing. What policy might succeed?
Well, I think Shadi laid out some of the options that we have. We're certainly not going to invade countries. We have neither the will nor the resources nor even the personnel to do so, nor do our allies. But it doesn't mean that we can't be smarter in our use of force right now. I mean, certainly backing the only credible United States ally in the region that has proven capable of taking on ISIS, which is the Kurds, either the Peshmerga or the YPG, is certainly one option. Having U.S. forces, you know, not just hanging back, but playing a more active role in directing airstrikes would be another one. But from my perspective, at least studying terrorism, the worst possible path is the one we're on, which is this graduated incrementalism that locks us into exactly what the terrorists want, this escalating, this upward escalatory tit-for-tat spiral that is eventually going to lead to, I think, an outcome of applying force to break the back of ISIS.
Quickly, Sebastian Rotella, what about Syria? It is often said that if we take out Assad, then there might be a vacuum and that ISIS could step into it.
Well, I mean, I think that's been what has caused this, what a lot of people have complained about, this view of the Obama administration and others, that it's not clear what side to strike, who to support against Assad. What is it worse if Assad falls? I mean, certainly it's true that right now ISIS is the player that has the attention of the world, and that is showing this remarkable willingness to engage in really savage violence and to try and export it and wherever it can. I mean, look at the number of attacks it's done. If it's true that airliner was brought down the other day, for example, so I think the question of Assad is something that I think there are different views in European capitals, for example, of ranging from more aggressive to less so about what to do about him. But certainly that's one of the things to keep in mind when you're trying to see which way the dominoes will go.
All right. Obviously, there's much more to talk about. We haven't mentioned Russia today, and it's going to be a factor of some kind in this area. And there are many, many other things to cover as well, and we'll do so as programs go on. And Sebastian Rotella, I understand you're on your way to Paris. We'll hope to talk to you when you're there. Again, senior reporter for ProPublica, author of the book The Convert's Song, which is about the terrorist underworld in Paris. Thanks to you. Thanks to Bruce Hoffman, director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University, Shadi Hamid with the Brookings Institution, Temptations of Power, Islamists, and Illegal Democracy in a New Middle East, Stephen Walt with the John F. Kennedy School, and our earlier guest, Janine DiGiovanni, with Newsweek in the Middle East. Presidential candidates of both political parties are holding forth about America's fight against ISIS. We'll compare and contrast their views in a moment on today's Talking Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. Hillary Clinton is not just a former First Lady and former Senator. She was also President Obama's first Secretary of State. Now she faces a difficult task in running to be his successor, since he is following a policy of containing ISIS. Here she is in Saturday night's Democratic primary debate in Iowa.
We have to look at ISIS as the leading threat of an international terror network. It cannot be contained. It must be defeated.
Shane Goldmacher reports for Politico. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me on.
So she explicitly says then that she does not want to follow the same policy as President Obama. Will the Republicans and the other Democrats as well try to tag her with it?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a case where Hillary Clinton's long resume and political experience cuts both ways. On the Democratic stage, she has so much more foreign policy chops than everybody else and, frankly, more experience than most all the Republicans. But she is closely linked to the Obama administration and its foreign policy. And when you see problems bubbling up throughout the Middle East, it's very hard for her to separate herself from the president she served with. So at the same time, she wants to say this is a race now to be commander-in-chief, and she wants to present herself as the best candidate for that. The challenge is every time you see something that's a bad headline anywhere in the Middle East, does she take some of the blame as well?
And is she forced then, if she is opposed to the president's current policy, to say so more directly if, in fact, she's pushed by people on the other side?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where Secretary Clinton is going to say something that the media will immediately identify as a break from the president. But frankly, an average viewer is not. When she says they need to not just be contained, now I know and you know that this is basically in contrast to Obama, who said days earlier, we're containing them. Obviously, that turned out to be not a good statement for the president the day before the Paris attacks. But for an average viewer, she's not telegraphing a difference from the president. That's really kind of for the insider. So people say, oh, she's distancing herself from him, while she really doesn't have to as far as a voter is concerned, especially a Democratic primary voter. And the Democratic primary voters are less hawkish than the overall electorate.
All right. One of the Democratic opponents, of course, Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, is running as a Democrat. He was asked on Saturday, what is the biggest threat to the United States?
Climate change is directly related to the growth of terrorism. And if we do not get our act together and listen to what the scientists say, you're going to see countries all over the world. This is what the CIA says. They're going to be struggling over limited amounts of water, limited amounts of land to grow their crops. And you're going to see all kinds of international conflict.
Shane Goldmacher, back to you. That's kind of the long-range view of the issue.
It really is. And especially, again, the timing is such that this comes one day after the attacks in Paris and the violence there. There's no question for the average Democratic primary voter that climate change is a really important issue. But the problem for climate change advocates for years has been that it's not an acute issue, that it doesn't have sort of a sharp point of important today or now. And Bernie Sanders is trying to give it that, but that's a tough sell, I think, for the average voter, that this is the most pressing and dangerous national security issue for the United States. It may well be for the long term, but for the short term, that's a very, very tough political argument to make, especially as Hillary Clinton is standing next to you and saying, that's not true, it's terrorism.
Bernie Sanders has been in the Senate for a long time. Has he focused on foreign affairs? Is he able to call on, service on a committee or anything of that kind?
Yeah, I mean, he has been in the Senate. He's certainly versant with these issues. He's comfortable with these issues. And that's a huge contrast with the Republican field, where some of the leaders in the polls just aren't. You know, Ben Carson, Donald Trump, they do not have foreign policy views that are well-articulated or well-formed over time, or certainly not heavy on the details. You know, Bernie Sanders is able to articulate that, but it's never been what he's focused on. I mean, his campaign is built around domestic policy issues. Income inequality, the power of Wall Street, the sort of corruptive influence of money and politics in the United States. These are the issues he's talking about. He's not talking day in and day out about issues in Iraq and Syria and Libya. That's just not the focus of his campaign. So while he does have experience in the Senate dealing with some of those issues, it's not where he wants to be running when he's running for president.
When politics are running as usual, then it would appear that domestic issues, and particularly the economy, remember it's the economy, stupid, tend to be very important in presidential campaigns. But all of a sudden, foreign affairs are rising to the top.
Yeah, and this is one of those things where the economy really leans, would be suggesting that the Democrats have a great advantage going into the next year. Historically, if the economy is booming, the party in power stays in power. And the economy right now is at about 5% unemployment. That's a really low unemployment figure. The problem for the Democratic Party is the economy may be booming on the macro level, but people don't seem to feel it. People continue to feel like they're being left behind, that there are problems in this economy, that the jobs that exist, they're less good-paying jobs. And so while the sort of the macro numbers suggest a great deal of improvement, you know, when I'm traveling around the country and talking to voters, and I'm hearing this from the campaigns when they do this too, there's a great deal of dissatisfaction. And so, you know, the domestic issue is sort of a little bit muddled and confusing because the economy looks like it's doing well. But people don't necessarily feel like it's doing well.
All right. Republicans, of course, are trying to make as much of this as they can. Here is Senator Marco Rubio of Florida talking about how to respond to what happened in Paris.
First, I would ask our allies to invoke Article 5. This was clearly an act of war, an attack on one of our NATO allies. And we should invoke Article 5 of the NATO agreement and bring everyone together to put together a coalition to confront this challenge.
Now, back to Shane Goldmacher. Article 5 of the NATO treaty says if one country is attacked, if it's an act of war, as President Hollande has said, then the others are supposed to rally to its defense.
Yeah, and I think that he's not the only Republican that's been calling for that. The issue is, A, does France want to do that? And if they do, I think it's pretty clear that the United States is probably going to stand with them. The Obama administration has not said that explicitly about Article 5, I don't believe, but has said they're going to stand with France on this. I mean, the United States is already involved militarily in Syria, trying to combat ISIS. It's really a matter of degree at this point. But, yeah, it's an important symbol that the United States and NATO allies do stand together, and that the basis of it was if there's an attack on one, everyone's supposed to consider it an attack on all.
Okay, and here is President Obama, who, of course, is not running again, but here's what he had to say about that.
Some of them seem to think that if I were just more bellicose in expressing what we're doing, that would make a difference, because that seems to be the only thing that they're doing.
So, Shane Goldmacher, then, the bottom line for the candidates is come up with something better.
Yeah, and I don't know that somebody has. You know, the challenge here, especially for the Republicans, is, as Obama says, they want to sound more bellicose than he is. They want to say that they're going to be more aggressive in solving this problem, and it's gotten worse, there's no doubt. The Islamic State has grown in existence under President Obama's watch. The challenge is, what do you do to sound more bellicose and stop short of advocating for more American troops on the ground, which remains an incredibly controversial proposal?
Although, of course, the two candidates, Senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, and the former senator from Pennsylvania, are advocating exactly that. Thanks a lot, Shane Goldmacher. Always good to talk with you, senior political reporter at Politico.
Thank you.
I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.